It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Pittsburgh is a complicated city with no shortage of pressing local issues, so many, in fact, that it might be difficult for some of us to find time to consider international topics. But what happens around the world profoundly impacts us here, and the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh not only reminds us of that fact, but continues to facilitate discussions designed to promote a deeper understanding of key global issues. For the past 5 years, Steve Sokol has been leading that effort as president of the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, after moving here from New York. So what impressions of the Steel City will this non-native Pittsburgh take back to New York when he begins his new job as president of the American Council on Germany? He joins us now in Studio A. Steve Sokol, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me on the show.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Steve, as you think back on your time here, not only with the World Affairs Council, you've had a chance to be involved in other community endeavors as a panelist on television and also as a guest host here on Essential Pittsburgh. So what are some of your impressions, and what will you be taking with you when you move back to New York?
Thanks, Paul. Great question to start with.
Of course. Aren't they all great
questions?
They're always
great questions. They're always great questions. Paul, no, seriously, I really came to Pittsburgh and did not know quite what to expect. I had visited Pittsburgh a couple of times. On each of my visits, I had been as far into Pittsburgh, as deep into Pittsburgh as the downtown triangle, the Golden Triangle, and that was about it. And so I really, within my first 6 months, came to a couple of not so startling conclusions for Pittsburghers, but really important conclusions for me. The first one was, this is a place where if you have energy and ideas, you can do some really amazing things. This is a community that's open to new ideas and new initiatives. But it's also a place where one can get access. In a bigger city like New York, good luck trying to meet the mayor. But in a city like Pittsburgh, it's possible as the head of a small nonprofit to meet with the mayor and to get the mayor on board with some key initiatives. So for me, as somebody who was new to Pittsburgh, I sort of took the approach of, I just want to be a sponge at first, and made the rounds, talked to lots and lots of people about the importance of developing a global understanding and about the role of the World Affairs Council in those efforts. And it really took off from there. The World Affairs Council is very active in area schools, mostly at the high school level and the middle school level. But it's also well established with the professional community. And one of the biggest challenges that I faced was how to engage younger and mid-career professionals as well as a more diverse
that
audience.
That is a challenge, isn't it? Younger, you know, you talk about people being diverse or diverse professionals. But are you finding, as some are, that people are becoming a little more myopic in their view of things, I'm only worried about what's happening here. What happens halfway around the world really doesn't affect me. There was an earthquake in Nepal. I really feel sorry for those people, those thousands of families who've experienced a death in the family. But you know, meanwhile, I'm worried about the roads are bad. Let's fill those potholes, that kind of thing.
That's obviously one of the big challenges that's facing this region, but other regions across the country as well. A lot of people have blinders on and aren't necessarily looking at the outside world, and yet we live in an increasingly complex but also interconnected world.
We have more access to it, and yet for some reason we don't always pay attention to it.
But I think that's why an organization like the World Affairs Council is so important, because one of the things that we started to do was really try to choose topics and themes that were more timely, more relevant, to shine a spotlight on them. But as we tried to engage a younger and more diverse audience, we also played around with the venue. We didn't just organize luncheon events during the middle of the day, which are not accessible for everybody, but we tried to find interesting venues like Bar Marco in the Strip District or the Livermore in East Liberty, or one of my favorites, Bricolage Production Company on Liberty Avenue. Great places that on a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday night were able to open their doors and serve as hosts for interesting policy discussions, but where you could also have a glass of wine or a beer and enjoy the discussion. And that was a way of breaking down some of the barriers Of course, it's a much deeper argument, a much bigger argument to be making constantly that what happens around the world matters to us. And I firmly believe that in this increasingly multicultural, multi-ethnic, and multilingual world of the 21st century, even if one doesn't go out into the world is coming to us. And we see that a little bit here in Pittsburgh. We see that with the number of foreign companies that are here. We see that with the international students who are here. And if we as a community don't have the tools to navigate this complex environment, we'll be left at a disadvantage.
And why do you suppose it is that even though we are more connected, that you have to make the argument? Why would you have to make that case? I mean, I don't doubt that you do and that you have, but why is it more of a challenge in the 21st century than it may have been decades ago? Because this is an old organization. It goes back to what, 1931?
That's correct. The World Affairs Council was founded in 1931, and its very first event actually focused on providing its audience with a deeper understanding of what was going on in Japan at that time. So think about that. 1931, mm-hmm. World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh is focusing on Japan. Very interesting when you put it in a historic perspective like that. And yet today, I think, as you mentioned in your intro, sometimes people lose sight of how important the international dimension is because of local issues and national issues that people might be facing. And yet I would go so far as to say that there's not really a career or a profession in the 21st century that doesn't have some sort of a global dimension to it. And that even here in Pittsburgh, it's a question of looking at how we as a region can compete globally with some of the wonderful products that we produce here, but also how we can collaborate internationally. And if we want to collaborate with people with different backgrounds who are from different cultures, we need to understand how to work with people who have these differences.
There's one more thing I want to get to before we take calls and go to some of our Twitter comments. And that is, what does the World Affairs Council do that people do not know about? You mentioned some things that already that people may not be aware of. And this is an organization that may or may not be underappreciated. So what are the things that people ought to know that you'd like people to know before you leave this city?
Well, let me start by saying on a regular basis, the council hosts some fantastic speakers from around the world, government officials, diplomats, corporate executives, leading journalists, people who shape policy in academia or think tanks. Some of them have name recognition. Sometimes they don't have name recognition. But they're always informative and insightful. Where I think the council is making a tremendous impact is in the work it does in area schools, mostly at the high school level, but also at the middle school level. And over the course of the last 5 years, the council's education team has really expanded its use of video conferencing technology to connect students in our region with their peers around the world to talk about a range of issues, from education and students' prospects on the job market to issues like human rights, human trafficking, global health, and more. And it's been incredibly impactful for students in our region to connect with their counterparts in places like Brazil, Pakistan, South Africa, Taiwan, Europe. And as a matter of fact, there's an ongoing series of video conferences connecting students here with students in our sister city in China, in Wuhan. Short of travel, this kind of an exchange in real time can be life-changing.
We're talking with Steve Sokol. He is the outgoing president of the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh. He is moving on to a new position in New York with the American Council on Germany. If you have a comment or question for him as he departs Pittsburgh in our exit interview here on Essential Pittsburgh, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Let's go to Lonnie calling from Highmark. Lonnie, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Steve Sokol.
Hey, Steve. Congratulations.
Thank you, Lonnie. It's great to hear you.
Quick question. I know with your tenure here in Pittsburgh at the American Council, what do you see or what do you take away from this position that you think that may have some type of impact on the transatlantic work that you usually that you did before at ACG, and specifically with the sort of bumps and dips that we've had in relationships with Germany?
Thanks, Lonnie. That's a terrific question. And I think one of the biggest takeaways that I have has been my engaging students here in the Pittsburgh area at the high school level, but also the college area. And as you know, Lonnie, one of my defining moments was being in Berlin in 1989 when the wall came down. And I doubt if I had not been there then that I would be here where I am today.
Why is that?
Well, it set me on a path. It set me on a trajectory. I've spent well over a decade living in Germany, studying there.
The wall gets knocked down. All of Germany opens up, or that eastern half of Germany opens up to the west. And that changes things for you?
It did. It was a catalyst for where I went to graduate school. It was a catalyst for sending me back to Germany in 93. But to come back to Lonnie's question, when you're in front of 20-year-olds or 17-year-olds, the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was a seminal point in my life, has been relegated to the history books for them. And
do they look at you and say, the Berlin what?
In some cases, yes, right? It's very far away. It's very far removed. And it has started me thinking about the fact that anybody who was five in 1989 when the wall came down or younger, so anybody today who's 30 or younger, has a different dimension. They're not thinking about the Marshall Plan and post-war reconstruction. They're not thinking about USGIs stationed in Germany. They're not thinking about the 2+4 agreement, which ultimately led to German reunification. Kids in Germany are thinking about the Iraq War. They're thinking about Edward Snowden. They're thinking about WikiLeaks. They're thinking about privacy issues and data issues. They have a completely different frame of reference. And one of the things that I'd like to take with me from my experiences in Pittsburgh is, how do we focus more on youth and create a new cohort of transatlanticists, a new generation of transatlanticists? There are many challenges facing us globally, things like pandemics, climate change, spread of terrorism or weapons of mass destruction that even the superpower USA can't solve by itself. We'll need allies. We'll need partners. Why not partner with the Europeans who have been such strong allies for such a long time?
I was going to say, some say that Germany is probably our most loyal ally right now, at this point in time.
On many levels. We might not agree with Germany all the time, and there are definitely some differences that we have that need to be discussed in my new role. But if you look at all of the issues where we collaborate with international partners, we cooperate most often with Germany.
And it probably hasn't helped us that the NSA has been listening in on Angela Merkel's phone calls, but that's probably another issue for another day, and one that you may have to smooth over in your new position, Steve. Let's go to Dwayne in Pittsburgh at 412-246-2002. Dwayne, welcome. How are you?
Thank you. Very good, and thanks for taking the call. First of all, congratulations, Steve. We're excited about you and your new opportunity, and as well, we're saddened because the city is going to lose an icon, but one that we will stay in touch with. Just want to thank you for all the great work that you've done in helping to promote the Global Passport Program, an initiative right aligned with trying to collaborate, allow students to collaborate with other students locally and abroad. And again, Steve, we just want to say thank you for all the good work you and your team have done. And we certainly look forward to working with you as you go to your new assignment.
Dwayne, thank you so much. The Global Passport Project is such a fantastic initiative, and it's one that even ties in with some of the new work that I'll be doing at the American Council on Germany, I think, because you, Dwayne, have really had a tremendous vision for providing students while they're in school with access to technical training and vocational training that will ultimately help them find their place in the workforce of tomorrow. And I think one of the biggest challenges that one has as an educator that we have in my generation is, how do we prepare students today for jobs tomorrow that we don't even know exist yet? And through your work, you've been able to actually take some lessons from Europe's dual education system of not just having classroom training, but really trying to make it practical and real world. And so thank you for your efforts, but also thank you for your kind comments.
Steve Sokol, you're leaving the Steel City to go back to the Big Apple to be the president of the American Council on Germany. And based on the mission statement, the American Council on Germany is an independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that promotes dialogue among opinion leaders and decision makers in the U.S. and Europe. And it doesn't sound a whole lot different from what you are doing now, but it'll be much more Deutschland-focused.
That's correct. It'll be a lot more Germany-focused and a lot more Europe-focused. I think with issues like the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership on the horizon, there are opportunities there. One of the things that's been very appealing and very rewarding about my work at the World Affairs Council has been the global perspective. However, having said that, returning to a more European-centric nonprofit is appealing to me because of my background. I spent my formative years in London. I've spent well over a decade living and working in Germany. And so in some senses, this is like going home. As somebody said to me recently, this is part of my DNA. But I actually think that we're at a critical juncture in the German-American relationship, not only because of issues like the one that you raised of the NSA scandal and the wiretaps on the German chancellor, but because there are a lot of knotty issues that need to be worked out between the U.S. and Europe.
Trust issues, it seems to be.
Trust issues. And so part of this is rebuilding trust across the Atlantic at a critical time.
Let's go to Cole in Pittsburgh at 412-246-2002. Cole, welcome. You're on with Steve Sokol.
I'm sorry. Good
That's
afternoon.
Okay.
I thought I'm an educator as well, and when I was in high school, I was an exchange student to a foreign country, and it completely changed the whole trajectory of my life.
Which country, Cole?
I went to Brazil. I lived in Southeast Brazil as a Rotary exchange student.
Sounds like a good place to end up as a young man.
It was, yeah. And, you know, for the past 10 years, I've had a chance to go back and forth and learned a lot from the intercultural travel. So my question for your guest is, what specific topics or kind of cultural items does he see youth becoming interested in the different sites that the World Affairs Council works with?
You know, there's a whole range of issues. One of the things that we found in the work at the World Affairs Council is that students around the world are interested in talking about education systems. They're interested in talking about what their future is like and what their job prospects are. But they're also very interested in addressing issues like human rights around the world or human trafficking or issues around the spread of pandemics, topics that sort of tie them together because they don't really know any international boundaries. One of the issues that I think is definitely going to come up is the issue of cybersecurity and sort of the digital world that we live in. Because if you think about it, the most modern technology for us as adults is the oldest technology that kids will be familiar with. And that technology is rapidly changing. So as we move forward in this digital world, how we handle data, how we handle privacy, how we handle information will be a key issue for young people to be thinking about.
Elizabeth on Twitter says she's looking forward to hearing how this, and I'm assuming she's referring to your new position, may positively affect European investment in the region here in Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention that. The American Council on Germany has a chapter here in Pittsburgh. It's headed by David Murdoch, who has been the chapter director here of the ACG's chapter for a number of years and provides some presence. But in a sense, more importantly, just last week, the honorary consul, Paul Overby, with a colleague who's an international business expert, Rachel Maurer, launched the German-American Chamber of Commerce here in Pittsburgh. And there's a lot of hope that the more than 100 or so German companies or subsidiaries of German companies can maintain activity here, and that with the chamber presence here and the council having a chapter here, that we can work together to perhaps attract greater trade and investment to this region. In my new role, I hope to be a strong advocate for this region. I think that there are a number of things that tie Germany and Southwest Pennsylvania together, not least of which is the fact that there are a lot of small and medium-sized companies here in the Pittsburgh area, and much of Germany's economy is driven by the Mittelstand, also small and medium-sized companies, often companies that have a niche product or a niche market. And this is something that I think can be leveraged on both sides of the Atlantic.
And, of course, we have a neighborhood here called Deutschtown. And so there are a lot of things that tie Pittsburgh to German culture. So this is one way. I'm assuming that you will maintain your ties with Pittsburgh is through this organization, simply because it makes sense to do that.
It does make a lot of sense. This region has a long and very deep ties to Germany, as you just mentioned, Paul. The first German and German-speaking immigrants started coming here at the beginning of the 19th century, and many of them settled in what's now known as Deutschtown. And so we often think of that German connection, but one doesn't always think of the fact that there are at least 100 or so German companies here in the area and that they also employ a number of people here.
It sounds like people who have called in, and I'm sure they represent many, many others who we have not heard from, but who are going to miss you when you go. And it sounds like you've really enjoyed your time at the World Affairs Council and in Pittsburgh.
I have. This has been just a fantastic opportunity for me. I've learned a lot. I've been able to experience a lot. I think the council has really grown and expanded its programming in this time. But more than anything else, I've had an incredible group of colleagues. The World Affairs Council is lucky to have an incredibly dedicated and passionate team. Each of the members of the team has had their own global experiences or international experiences and has really worked tirelessly to try to promote the mission of the World Affairs Council. And so it's really sort of with a laughing eye and a crying eye that I move on, because my colleagues here have been terrific, and it's been a great opportunity. Pittsburgh is a wonderful place. I've been able to really see how this city has gone through its periods of structural change and its periods of transition and come out of it looking ahead. And I guess one of my hopes is that this region doesn't sort of rest its laurels on the successes that it's had in the past couple of decades, but really rises to the challenges of the 21st century and pursues a stronger global identity and a place on the world stage, because I certainly think that this region has the opportunity to position itself for that.
Steve Sokol is the outgoing president of the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh and the newly elected president of the American Council on Germany in New York. Steve, it's been a pleasure having you not only today, but during your past visits. Also, we appreciate the help that you've given to this program by providing us with very compelling guests and on occasion filling in for me. You've been a real help, a real friend to us and to Pittsburgh. We thank you, and we wish you well.
Well, thank you, Paul. It's been a great association, and I've really enjoyed my involvement with WESA, and I promise I'll keep trying to send great guests your way.
Sounds good. I appreciate that. Coming up, our next exit interview with Pittsburgh Tribune Review columnist Neferi Vanaski, who's leaving Pittsburgh for a job in Florida? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For the past dozen years, Neferi Vanaski has worked for Trib Total Media, mainly in the newsroom of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. And for the past 5 years, she's had her own column focused mainly on raising awareness of social issues. She's offered her take on domestic violence in the NFL, child rearing, and other travails of modern life. But she's leaving the Steel City to work as an assistant managing editor of the Lakeland, Florida Ledger. She joins us now in our Community Broadcast Center studio for our second exit interview of the day. Neferi Vanaski, good to have you with us. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Sad to hear that you're leaving.
I know.
It's been that kind of day. When you began writing your column, What ideas did you have about how you wanted to approach it and the issues that you wanted to address?
Well, I was really excited when I started my column because I thought this is like, I'm like a kid in a candy shop. You know, I just get to do anything. I could just go out in Pittsburgh and find anybody and write anything. And so I wouldn't say I had any specific ideas about what exactly I was going to write, but I did want to meet people in Pittsburgh and talk to the people who lived here and find out more about them, because I always found when I would just talk to people, you just, the little nuggets you get about them, and they're always so interesting. And I just, that's what I was hoping for. And I feel like that's what I did. I feel like it was a lot of fun getting to know the people of Pittsburgh.
And so as this evolved and as you began to get a clearer picture of how you wanted to approach things, what have you been focusing on? I gave the synopsis in the introduction, but obviously your ideas, the evolution of them and how you approached issues in our city has evolved. So what have you been focusing on? How has this column evolved?
One thing I wanted when I started, I didn't want to be just solely known as the Black columnist, you know. And so I thought, you know, I want to relate to everyone and not just make it about color or anything like that. And I think that can happen sometimes. And so I didn't want to focus on that as much until it became an issue. And over the years,
did it become an issue?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
how so?
Well, I would say the main thing that really made me begin to focus on race was the Trayvon Martin case. And when I did that, I realized that I was saying things that needed to be said. And I'm not saying that everyone agreed with the things I said, but I felt that, you know, talking about, you know, race, Black men in the police, these are things that are, you know, these are things you need to talk about. And I would say in this country in general, we have a hesitation to go there. And so, and in honesty, I had a hesitation to go there because I didn't, you don't want to alienate people, but at the same time, it just, the issue became too big. It's obviously bigger now. And so I don't regret that. I'm glad it happened. That not those incidents, but I'm glad that I was able to start that dialogue with readers.
And perhaps to be in the position you were in at this point in history.
Right.
And did you find that that those issues are being thought about differently, handled differently, discussed differently here in Pittsburgh as opposed to other parts of the country? I mean, and it's a coincidence that you happen to be here on the day that Freddie Gray's funeral is being held in Baltimore. But obviously, that city is going through its own inner turmoil right now. Mm-hmm. And we've had similar issues here in Pittsburgh.
Right.
We have not had the kind of outpouring of grief and the emotional, visceral reaction that we're seeing in Baltimore here, even though we've had incidents that have been just as tragic involving the police and African-American men in this city. So how would you compare how we talk about it here in Pittsburgh with maybe how it's dealt with in other parts of the country?
As a columnist getting individual feedback from readers, I was surprised a lot of the time by readers who just didn't seem to think that, I think they felt that race was an issue for Black people and that it wasn't something, I think it was just the thing where a lot of the readers I dealt with, especially early on, seemed to think that I was blowing things out of proportion.
Really?
And I just think that is an experience they just hadn't had. And I think now,
let me jump in. How much does that do you think that had to do with the fact that, you know, you can perceive it to lesser or greater extents, but the Tribune Review is viewed as the conservative newspaper in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. and the newspaper, the Trib people in their advertising have gone to great pains to say, you know, we may have a right of center point of view on issues, but we report straight down the middle. Mm-hmm. But as an African American woman writing an opinion column, how much of that had to do with your readership, the reactions that you got?
I think that's accurate. I think that the readership of the Trib, as far as the feedback I would get, did tend to be more conservative. But I always thought that was a good thing because
that it gave you a greater opportunity to talk to the people that might have the most difficulty with these issues.
Right. You're preaching to the choir otherwise. And so it was always a good challenge for me to, you know, kind of interact with readers whenever I got a chance and say, well, you know, let's actually talk about this. And it was really hard at the beginning because I wasn't used to people just kind of blindly rejecting something out of hand. I mean, I always expected that when I would talk to people, we would have a discourse and say, okay, well, tell me why you feel that way. And when it comes to race, it is really hard for people to talk about why they feel that way. And I feel like that is at the root of our problems with race in this country, is that it's just hard for us to just be honest and about how we feel. And so the times when I was able to interact with readers and they were just like, you know, straight up with me, and they felt like I could be straight up with them, it was good interaction and good experience. And I actually felt like that increased as I, you know, kept addressing race.
And was it in some way cathartic for you, if not necessarily for them always? Did it help to just initiate a straightforward discussion,
right,
and put it out there and be straight with people and not have to, you know, approach it from such a delicate mm-hmm. point of view?
Well, it was and it wasn't. I mean, it was helpful for me because I really thought that what we needed and what we need at this point are people to be straightforward about their thoughts on race and, you know, police relations, all aspects. So for me, I thought that was a great thing. And I think for readers, it was one of those issues that, you know, it just touches a nerve. And so there were many who appreciated it. And then there were some who just didn't appreciate it and felt, you know, could we just move on to something else? I mean, why do we always have to talk about this? And that's why I wanted to make sure that I wasn't always talking about it, because it's certainly true that there are other things going on out there.
And you did, in fact, write about a lot of those other things. Yeah. And we're talking with Neferi Vanaski, who has been a columnist for the last 5 years, spent the last dozen years at Trib Total Media and the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. If you have a comment or question, you can join the conversation, 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH. So let's talk about some of the other topics that you brought up in your columns. You are a mom, right?
I am.
You are. So you have concerns that other moms have, obviously, about things like education and mm-hmm. keeping our kids safe. Mm-hmm. What were some of the things that you wrote about that, you know, in your column that really resonated from people and that, you know, you found a lot of common ground with?
Well, most recently, it was this debate over, quote-unquote, free-range parenting, which I sort of regard as kind of just letting your kid grow up. But I know that it's...
What does that mean exactly?
Well, I really think that's what it means. I think that it's called that by, I think, critics who want to...
Not over-parenting? Is that it?
Yeah. Okay. It's just, you know, kind of letting your kid be a kid. Let your kid climb a tree every now and again, you know, kind of the situation in Maryland with the the Mesa family in Maryland who let their children go to the park by themselves. I think they were 6 and 10 years old, and that raised a lot of concern out there. But I found in writing about that a couple of times, especially recently, that a lot of readers grew up like that. And a lot of people grew up like that. And I think it's one of those situations where you have a like small minority of people, you know, raising a racket over something where most people are probably trending more towards, you know, let your kid be a kid.
You grew up in Brooklyn.
I did.
So how did your parents, were they helicopter parents?
No.
They let you take the subway and go places by yourself?
Yeah.
At what age?
I was probably in elementary school. Well, I was definitely in elementary school, and I would walk to school with my brother. He was 3 years younger than I am. We'd walk to school, and it was not as far as, you know, the mile that these kids in Maryland might have been walking. But we did go by ourselves, and because it was Brooklyn, there's this huge, you know, at this point it's probably like 6-lane road, and it was high traffic. But what my parents did, they walked with us at first, and they made sure that we were listening to directions. Obviously, you're not going to want to take a toddler out there and say, you know, cross Utica Avenue. But, you know, that's part of what parenting is, you know, you want your kid to experience things too. You don't want to always be hovering. And I think it's a temptation. It really is, you know.
Was it for you at all?
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's like you're at the park with your kids and you're watching them play and you're, oh, man, that's high. You could hurt yourself. But, you know, and obviously you're not going to let, I wouldn't let my child do anything crazy. But, you know, there's an instinct where you just don't, you know, you don't want anything to happen. But then you realize, okay, this is part of growing up. You know, I'm here for you. But you can do this.
Did that resonate with your readers?
It did. And I was surprised. There were probably just a couple of readers who just disagreed with me, but I could understand them. I think that one reader said, well, you know, I'm in Homewood. I'm not going to let my kid walk around in Homewood. And if you have concerns about your neighborhood, that's certainly, that's the right thing for you to do. And I wouldn't question that. I wouldn't call that being a hovering parent. That's you using your head. But I do. I when I take my kids to the park, I see a lot of people just like literally right behind their kid with their hands out, and I can almost see myself there. But then I'm just like, no, you're not going to do that. I'm going to let you grow up.
So most people agreed with you, some didn't, and I'm guessing you did not write a column over those 5 years where everybody that you know on those. And I've read some of your columns and read others, and if you go online, of course there are all those online comments in a row. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing you never wrote a column where everybody agreed with what you said, or did you?
There was one, and it was entirely blank. No,
that's a passive agreement. So you grew up in Brooklyn, you've come to Pittsburgh, you've spent 5 years, you know, opining in the big city, and now you're going to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And you just wrote this column recently about all the, you know, Florida's known for all these crazy things, like the guy who decided that he wanted to kiss a poisonous snake and then, you know, was bitten. I assume he survived that. But, you know, why there? Why Lakeland, you know? That seems like a strange destination for a big city woman.
Well, my husband and I, we have been talking about, you know, it's kind of been our dream over the years to, you know, look for a warmer place to live. You know, we've been here for 12, 13 years.
Hey, it was 41 this morning. What are you talking about?
You know, this current weather is not exactly making me doubt the decision,
not.
You know? It is late April. But, yeah, you know, it was that when you're at a place for 12 years, there is a restlessness that can set in sometimes. And it's certainly not because of a lack of enjoyment of the job. It's just, you know, you do the same things over and over again. And I just thought, you know, this opportunity came up, and that's another part of something I've always wanted to do with my career is work with young journalists. And there are a lot of those at the Lakeland Ledger. And I think it's really important to do this kind of thing right now because journalism is at a really strange place. And people are very concerned about the future. And I am not as concerned about the future. I know that journalism will always be there. It's going to be in a different shape and form. And I just want to be a part of that. I want to be a part of working with young journalists and just seeing where journalism is going to take us next and what it's going to look like next.
Well, we're certainly glad that you've been a part of Pittsburgh for these last dozen years or so. Neferi Vanaski has been with Trib Total Media for that length of time and has been a columnist for the last 5 years for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. She's moving on to Lakeland, Florida, the Lakeland Ledger, where she will be the assistant managing editor. Neferi, thank you for your appearances on the program here on Essential Pittsburgh. We'll miss you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll look at an effort to save a Pittsburgh landmark dating back to 1782. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Dating back to 1782, the last year of the Revolutionary War, the Old Stone Tavern in Pittsburgh is the oldest commercial building in this area. However, like so many old structures, it's in need of repair and the threat of destruction looms. I'm joined now in Studio A by two gentlemen who are trying to prevent that. Rich Forrester, who is a board member for Friends of the Old Stone Tavern. Rich, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much.
And also John McNulty, who is as well a board member for the Friends of the Old Stone Tavern. Again, these are a group of citizens who would like to see the building saved and possibly function as a cornerstone of a West End historic district. Let's talk first about the historical significance of this building, if we could, gentlemen. And this goes back, I don't know if you really need to say more than the fact that this building goes back to 1782, the last year of the Revolutionary War. Who would have been frequenting this particular tavern? What sort of history should we know about regarding this building?
Well, thank you very much. What happened with the Old Stone Tavern, it has not only the building, which is circa 1782, it has a date stone that actually says 1752. And people that would frequent it, which is great because we have a ledger, which is in the library at Oakland and in a Pennsylvania room. What happens is in that ledger, there are entries of various people that visit it. For example, Gabriel Walker and Isaac Walker. Isaac Walker has a cabin, log cabin in the Botanic Gardens. He was there. His brother Gabriel were there. He has a log cabin, a log house on Noblestown and Collier Township. Both of these gentlemen were participants in the Whiskey Rebellion. They were actually arrested and taken to Philadelphia, and they were released. So these are just the entries in there saying that these gentlemen were there. It had ferries going from there over to the north side of Pittsburgh. They would go into the tavern, and they would consume a gill of whiskey for one penny. And I think a gill of whiskey is like 4 ounces, so that's quite quite a little bit of whiskey. And they would ferry their family from one side of the river to the other. Another person that's of interest is Jacob Free, who's a American Revolution veteran. And he actually has a site in Coriopolis where his grave site. So what we have at the Old Stone Tavern is not just a building, but we also have its ledger, which brings it to life to me and anybody that would like to look at it. And if anyone wants further information, please go to our website, which is postfriendstrust.org. We have two folks that really study the history, Noreen Beatty and Michael Sheely, and they can offer much greater detail in this history. But just to summarize, we are trying to save it. We have a 501c3. Our organizations consist of volunteers, and what we're trying to do is get funding and save it for the future.
And we'll have a link to your website at ours at WESA.FM. And so, John, talk about some of the things that need to be done to save this building.
Well, if I could just add on one thing, Rich was saying about the ledger, the primary source material, that covers the period from 1793 to 1796. So that's the one link we have to the Whiskey Rebellion. So obviously it's been there for all the parts of American history, But that's one of the salient features. But your earlier question about who would have used it, basically anybody going to the south and the southeast. You have to think of Pittsburgh before there were tunnels going through Mount Washington.
Hard to imagine.
Exactly, right? Well, not for North Hillers, I suppose. But that first breach, the natural breach in the terrain, is the Sawmill Run Creek. That's the sawmill that had that processed the wood to build Fort Pitt. So that Sawmill Run Valley is part of the genesis story of Pittsburgh, if you will. That's the earliest industrial site around here. So that Old Stone Tavern was in a very strategic position at the intersection of people along the Sawmill Run Creek and also the Catfish Trail that linked to the National Road, Route 40, which does not come to Pittsburgh, goes from Uniontown to Wheeling. So anybody transversing that area, for instance, the wagon supply of Lewis and Clark in the summer of 1803 would have gone by ferry to the mouth of the Sawmill Run Creek, past the Old Stone Tavern, probably had a cherry toddy, and then on into the hinterland. It's where the frontier met the maritime military district. And that's what's so exciting.
Incredible history there.
Very exciting.
So what is the condition of the building now? Obviously, some things have been done to it in, you know, the last, 200 and what's it been? 260
right.
years or so?
Right.
So where does it stand now?
Sure. So the building is really part of a larger complex that's owned by a businessman. It's great because we have a lot of industrial heritage there. But the person who owns it has other holdings. So they would like to move to a location where they can have space. So it's kind of in the way, as it were, for other things that are happening in the area right now. But in the 50s or the 60s, there were people renting apartments for at some point, so they would put things that were more modern. So and it has been unoccupied since 2009, so time is creeping up. The roof's still in good shape. We have an architect, Michael Shealy, who really goes in there and knows a lot of the details about, you know, whenever the renovations begin. But that's what makes it a little more complex, because we need to honor the person who would like to move their operations to a new location. And if that is accomplished, then we have a better chance at establishing like a living history district and move other, for instance, critical buildings to that location and have it be part of a 5-year like environmental ecotourism development for the Western Valley.
And by the way, I was basing that figure of 260 years old on the date stone built AD 1752, not the 1782, which I mentioned earlier, even though that's what it officially...
You might be able to find that out if we get in there and do some dendrochronology. And imagine the parking lots. That this land near the tavern has never been tilled under. So if you're going to put in a parking lot, first do an archaeological dig. We can find out a lot
sure.
more clues. We're going to find all kind of stuff.
Well, it sounds like it. Now, we've got less than a minute left. So let me ask you, Rich, about the your logo and the symbolism of the logo.
Well, the logo is essentially a bottle or a wine or a whiskey bottle with the leaves going up the side of it. And essentially it has the three leaves standing for the three rivers as a point where this at the Old Stone Tavern, people could take a boat and ferry over there, for essentially 3 cents. And the mission of the Old Stone Tavern is to secure the Old Stone Tavern and its property and preserve it and educate the public regarding its significance in history to the country. It kind of functions as a Rosetta Stone to this community.
Well, it is a fascinating history, and it is a very worthy mission that you're both on. I want to thank you for coming in to share some details.
$5 a year to be a member. You know, we need to show that people care. You know, we'll get the grant money, but we need the people just to kind of be general member. You don't have to come to monthly meetings or weekly.
Well, we're happy to help you get your story out there. Thanks to Rich Forrester, who is the honorary director, board member for Friends of the Old Stone Tavern, and John McNulty, board member for the Friends of the Old Stone Tavern, dating back to either 752 or 1782, depending.
It's old.
Great history. Yes. Thank you, gentlemen. Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, we'll talk about the last days of Vietnam with a Pittsburgh man who was there. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.